The reading this morning is from the first book of Samuel, and it's chapter 7. So the men of Kiriath-Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord. They took it to Abinadab's house on the hill and consecrated Eleazar his son to guard the ark of the Lord. It was a long time, 20 years in all, that the ark remained at Kiriath-Jearim. And all the people of Israel mourned and sought after the Lord. And Samuel said to the whole house of Israel, "If you are returning to the Lord with all your hearts, then rid yourselves of the foreign gods and the Ashtoreths, and commit yourselves to the Lord and serve him only, and he will deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines." So the Israelites put away their Baals and Ashtoreths and served the Lord only. Then Samuel said, "Assemble all Israel at Mizpah, and I will intercede with the Lord for you." When they had assembled at Mizpah, they drew water and poured it out before the Lord. On that day they fasted, and there they confessed, "We have sinned against the Lord." And Samuel was leader of Israel at Mizpah. When the Philistines heard that Israel had assembled at Mizpah, the rulers of the Philistines came up to attack them. And when the Israelites heard of it, they were afraid because of the Philistines. They said to Samuel, "Do not stop crying out to the Lord our God for us, that he may rescue us from the hand of the Philistines." Then Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it up as a whole burnt offering to the Lord. He cried out to the Lord on Israel's behalf, and the Lord answered him. While Samuel was sacrificing the burnt offering, the Philistines drew near to engage Israel in battle. But that day, the Lord thundered with loud thunder against the Philistines and threw them into such a panic that they were routed before the Israelites. The men of Israel rushed out of Mizpah and pursued the Philistines, slaughtering them along the way to a point below Beth-Kar. Then Samuel took a stone and set it up between Mizpah and Shen. He named it Ebenezer, saying, "Thus far has the Lord helped us." So the Philistines were subdued and did not invade Israelite territory again. Throughout Samuel's lifetime, the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines. The towns from Ekron to Gath that the Philistines had captured from Israel were restored to her. And Israel delivered the neighboring territory from the power of the Philistines. And there was peace between Israel and the Amorites. Samuel continued as judge over Israel all the days of his life. From year to year, he went on a circuit from Bethel to Gilgal to Mizpah, judging Israel in all those places. But he always went back to Ramah, where his home was, and there he also judged Israel, and he built an altar there to the Lord.
So after the account of the Philistines and the Ark of the Covenant, Samuel once again takes center stage in the narrative, and he does so as leader of the Israelites, a role traditionally translated as judge. And as we look at this passage, there are some lessons that I will draw out about leadership. We may not find ourselves in positions of leading a nation or facing military danger or even leading a church or a large organization, but we will all be leaders at one time or another. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, one definition of leadership is the art of motivating a group of people to achieve a common goal. The art of motivating a group of people to achieve a common goal. And there will be times in all of our lives when we are called on to do just that. So I think it'll be useful to look at what we can learn from Samuel in this, the first test of his leadership. Samuel was the last of the judges, leaders who had been chosen by God going back to the time since Joshua died and leading up to the time of the kings. Judges were usually appointed to rescue Israel from their enemies, as well as exercising social, judicial, and spiritual authority. It is worth recalling why Israel had enemies and why judges were raised up periodically. In Judges chapter 2, verses 1 to 5, we read that God rebuked the Israelites for having made agreements with the inhabitants of the land and not having driven out completely their idolatry. This was a direct breach of the covenant that they had made with God. As a result, God declared that he would not drive out the remaining peoples and that their gods would become snares and tests for the Israelites. What happened next was a fairly depressing cycle. The Israelites would follow the Lord as long as there was a judge leading them, but as soon as he, or in one case she, died, they would quickly fall back into idolatry, and God would allow an enemy to oppress them, until they turned back to him and cried out for rescue. Then God would appoint another judge to deliver them, and they would follow the Lord as long as that judge was alive, and then repeat the cycle all over again. So it is into this cycle that we see Samuel at this point as Israel's judge. Why had God appointed Samuel as a judge at this time? There were usually two conditions for when God raised up a judge: idolatry, leading to a withdrawal of God's protection, and as a result, an enemy who was oppressing the Israelites. Now, looking back through the book of 1 Samuel so far, we do not see a lot of evidence of idolatry, but verse 4 of 1 Samuel 7 makes it clear that it was prevalent. And what we have also seen is the clear lack of true spiritual leadership from the house of Eli, resulting in God's condemnation of Eli and his family and their removal from position of leadership. And there was certainly an enemy. Going back to 1 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 9, we read that the Philistines warned themselves to fight, or they would become subject to the Hebrews, as the Hebrews have been subject to them. So even going back that far, we see Philistine dominance and oppression of the Israelites. And then, of course, after that, the Philistines had decisively defeated the Israelites and even captured the Ark of the Covenant, although they had subsequently returned it. And we can see from chapter 7 and verse 3 that Israel was still subject to the hand of the Philistines. So let us look at this passage in a bit more detail to see what we can learn about Samuel's leadership of Israel. In terms of when this took place, it's not clear from verse 2 whether the 20 years that it's mentioned there has been the time since the ark was returned up until this point, or whether that 20 years refers to another period of time and this incident took place at some point within it. But we can see that Samuel is definitely recognized as leader. And he is leader of the whole house of Israel. He is God's appointed judge. It is also clear from verse 3 that the Philistines, although they had returned the ark, they are still in a position of military dominance. They are still oppressing Israel. We read in chapter 4, verse 10, that after the last battle, Israel had fled every man to his home or his tent. No army had marched out in the intervening period to oppose the Philistines, and they were free to oppress the Israelites pretty much as they liked. So it is in the context of this oppression that Israel lamented after the Lord, as verse 2 is translated in the King James or the English Standard Version, or turned back to the Lord, as it says in the NIV. We are not told directly the nature of this lament, but we can deduce from what Samuel says in verse 3 and from the cyclical narrative of the book of Judges that it would probably have started just as a cry for help and deliverance, and would likely have been some way short of full repentance. In answer to their cry, Samuel brings a message from the Lord, and his message is clear. God's help is conditional on their wholehearted obedience. They must put away idolatry, direct their hearts to God, and serve him only. God has always and will always demand full and wholehearted obedience. Jesus himself attested that the first and greatest commandment is love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength, as it says in Luke 10 verse 27, quoting from Deuteronomy chapter 6. But it is credit both to the Israelites and to Samuel's leadership that the people did just that. It is only then that Samuel gathers them to Mizpah. And he doesn't gather them for battle, whatever the Philistines might think. No, he gathers them for a public act of repentance and rededication to the Lord. It is more important to be right with God than to be free from oppression. There is fasting and prayer and public acknowledgement and confession of their sin. Now we are told in verse 5 that all Israel gathered at Mizpah. We can presume, therefore, that this would have been at least a representative from every family or clan. And this would have been a sizable gathering and would have taken a considerable amount of time to organise. Messengers must have gone to the furthest tribes and preparations must have been made before the representatives set off. As given the distances that some of them would have had to travel, they would likely have been away from home for a few weeks. Now Mizpah, as well as being a central point in Israel, means watchtower, and it is situated on high ground, a good vantage point militarily. It also means that it can be seen from a great distance, and large groups of people congregating there would easily be noticed. So it is no surprise that by the time the last groups of Israelites have gathered, the Philistines have seen and heard about it. Now, whether they thought that this was a prelude to war and decided on a preemptive strike, or whether it was simply too good an opportunity to miss to further subdue their local enemies, we don't know, but the outcome was the same. The rulers of the Philistines led their forces to attack Israel. Again, such preparations did not go unnoticed, this time by the Israelites from their elevated position in Mizpah. And they were afraid. The last time they had met this enemy on the field of battle, it had resulted in disaster and the loss of the Ark of the Covenant. The story of such a calamity must have become a huge wound in the national psyche. And even worse than the military effects of the battle were the spiritual effects. They had taken the Ark with them and lost. The Ark of the Covenant itself had been captured. As we heard a couple of weeks ago in 1 Samuel chapter 4 verse 22, the glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God has been captured. And given their own understanding of their sin and guilt, fresh in their minds from their public act of repentance, there may even have been doubt in their minds whether God would want to save them. And yet, they recognized that God was their only hope. The contrast between this event and the previous battle could not be more stark. Previously, they had been self-confident, arrogant, and sure that the presence of the Ark itself would save them, either because they thought it had some power in and of itself, or because they thought that they could force God to help them by taking the Ark with them. Surely God would defend his ark, no matter how great the sin of the people who carried it. But they were very wrong. Now, in fear and trembling, and with great humility, they plead with Samuel to earnestly intercede for them. The sense of, "Do not stop crying out to the Lord for us," that we have in verse 8, shows their trust in Samuel as leader and mediator, and their full reliance on God for salvation from their enemies. And Samuel sacrificed a lamb as a burnt offering, a sign of atonement and reconciliation, and it says his prayers were answered. Verse 10 makes clear that the victory was fully God's. The Philistines drew near while Samuel was still sacrificing the burnt offering. There is no indication that the Israelites were ready, either militarily or psychologically, to oppose them, but they didn't need to be. Samuel had his priorities right. He focused on God first, not the approaching enemy, and God did the rest. The Lord thundered with loud thunder, presumably involving lightning as well, and threw the Philistines into a panic. that God used thunder to scatter the Philistines was also a sign to the Israelites. Baal, who they had been following until recently, was supposedly God of thunder as well as God of fertility. So the Lord was demonstrating to the Israelites that he was the one true God. He was in control of the whole earth, thunder, as well as everything else. And he would use it to secure his victory. And Baal was nothing but a useless idol. So God thundered, and the Philistines were thrown into confusion and panic. And it was only after the Philistine battle lines were broken, and they were fleeing back down the hill, that the Israelites burst out of Mizpah and pursued them. The slaughter was finished by the Israelites, but the victory belonged to God. And Samuel acknowledged this by setting up the memorial stone, Ebenezer, to mark the victory. Ebenezer means stone of help, which is why he said, "Thus far the Lord has helped us." And "thus far" is ambiguous and probably deliberately so. It could mean up until now, or it could mean this far in terms of distance. And both are true. And there may be another reason why Samuel named the memorial Ebenezer. In 1 Samuel chapter 4, we read that the battle where the ark was lost took place at Ebenezer. Given that that battle was close to Shiloh, which is further to the north, it is unlikely to be the same place as this memorial, which is somewhere further south, probably between Mizpah and the Philistine territory. So it is also possible that Samuel was reclaiming the name Ebenezer as a memorial that God had helped them and undoing some of the hurt caused from the earlier defeat, where because of their own sinfulness and arrogance, God hadn't helped them. And after this victory at Mizpah, we read that the Philistines were subdued and stopped invading Israel's territory, verse 13. But we know from later in 1 Samuel that the Philistines were still a dangerous opponent right up until the time of King David. So this subdual must be seen in the light of subsequent events to have been, at this point anyway, a limited withdrawal by the Philistines into the heart of their own territory, but giving up some previously conquered towns as they did so. But however limited it was, Israel experienced a time of relative peace after this. Even the local Amorite population, the Canaanite people, who, don't forget, had not yet been driven out completely, didn't cause any fuss. It may be that they were pleased that the Israelites had dealt a blow to the Philistines, as I don't think the Philistines would particularly have distinguished much between the Israelites and the Amorites when it came to oppression. And the final comments in this chapter describe Samuel's practice of making an annual circuit from Bethel to Gilgal to Mizpah and back again. None of these places were actually very far apart from each other, probably not more than a day's walk. But they were all pretty central to Israel, and so relatively easy for anyone to get to from whatever extreme. And it was also close to Samuel's hometown of Ramah, which he also visited. So in the absence of a recognized capital city, it probably made sense for Samuel to show his face in a number of places. Leadership by walking around, perhaps. We can also see from verse 17 that as well as political or judicial leadership, Samuel was also exercising some level of spiritual leadership as he built an altar to the Lord at Ramah. Now, on the subject of spiritual leadership, it is interesting to note that Shiloh is not mentioned as a place that Samuel visited, nor led the people from, even though it was close to Gilgal. Shiloh had been a central meeting place and worship since the time of Joshua. So Samuel's avoidance of it is worth considering briefly. One theory for why it is not mentioned is that the town may have been destroyed after the battle in chapter 4. Shiloh as a place is certainly not mentioned after 1 Samuel chapter 4 until in 1 Kings chapter 11, towards the end of the reign of King Solomon many years later. So it may be that it just didn't exist. Another possible reason is spiritual. Eli and his family had been priests in Shiloh, and God had condemned them and their ministry. In Psalm 78, which is a spiritual history of Israel, we read in verses 60 and 61 that he, that is God, abandoned the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent he had set up among humans. He sent the ark of his might into captivity, his splendor into the hands of the enemy. By avoiding Shiloh, Samuel was avoiding association with the previous corrupt worship and the place that God had abandoned. We also find references to Shiloh in Jeremiah chapter 7 and chapter 26, where he compares a corrupt and godless Jerusalem to Shiloh and warns the people that they will share the same fate. God will abandon his temple as he did the tent at Shiloh, and Jerusalem will be desolate and deserted as Shiloh became. So perhaps this implies that both reasons were true. God had abandoned Shiloh as his place where his presence was, and the town had been destroyed. It is a sobering lesson, although not one that Jerusalem learned. But what lessons can we learn from Samuel's leadership that we can apply to ourselves? Remember, leadership is the art of motivating a group of people to achieve a common goal. Well, the first lesson comes almost straight from a leadership handbook. It is the role of a leader to state the problem, to describe the vision, and to lay out the path to get there. In other words, what is wrong with where we are now? Where would we like to get to, and how will we get there? Samuel does this very succinctly in verse 3. The problem is that the people are not following God, and therefore God is not protecting them. It is important to recognize the spiritual cause, idolatry, rather than the physical symptom, God's lack of protection and the Philistine oppression. If they want to get back to being right with God and therefore under his protection, and that's the vision, then the path to get there is clear. Rid yourselves of foreign gods and commit yourself to the Lord and serve him only. Now, we may not worship foreign gods as the Israelites did, but there are still things that test and snare us. Remember what the writer of the Hebrews said. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. It is the same message. Get rid of anything that will take your eyes off the Lord. Fix your eyes on him only. It was relevant then, and it is still relevant now. The first thing that we need to learn from Samuel is that we need to be right with God and fixing our eyes on him before anything else. We should examine ourselves as the Israelites did, confess our sin to God, and ask for his forgiveness. The second lesson follows on from the first. We need to know what our purpose is, and don't take our eyes off that, no matter what the distractions. The Philistines were approaching in force, but Samuel knew where his priorities lie. His mission, his purpose, was to intercede with God, not prepare the Israelites for battle. So he carried on with the sacrifice, even as the Philistines drew near, and trusted that God would do the rest. We can sometimes get carried away with trying to do God's job for him, because we feel that we are or should be responsible for the results. Let me give you an example. Just before the start of a large youth mission in Newbury that I was helping to lead more than 20 years ago, my father gave me some good advice. He said, "Your job is not to convert people. That is God's job. You just need to do what God has called you to do to the best that you can and leave the results to him." God calls us to be obedient to him and to what he has called us to do, not to try to take on responsibilities that are not our concern. It may be that God has planned a job for someone else to do. It may be that God will intervene in a different way. Whatever the situation, God knows the end from the beginning. He is sovereign and he is in control. Matters beyond what he has called us to do are above our pay grade, as the Archbishop of York once said. The final lesson of leadership is to remind people where they have come from and how they got to where they are now. Samuel took a stone and named it Ebenezer to remind the people that the Lord had helped them. It wasn't by their own hand that they had been delivered. It was because of what God had done. And this is still an important principle because it is all too easy to forget. Either to forget where we started or how we got to where we are now. And we have acts of remembrance and memorial all around us. Last Sunday was Remembrance Sunday, where as a nation we remember the debt we owe to those who have served and still serve our country. And at work we have learning reviews or retrospectives. What do we need to remember? Where have we come from? What worked? What didn't work? What should we continue doing? And what should we stop doing? And we need to do this in our spiritual lives as well, so that we don't forget what God has done for us. And we don't forget what he has promised us. God knows us completely, and he knows how prone to forgetfulness we can be. So he constantly reminds us through his word. Each of us also has our own testimony, our own story of God's grace and love to us thus far. These are our own Ebenezers. And we should remind each other of them to encourage each other. It is also good to remind ourselves of them because our testimonies, our personal stories, will be part of our witness to non-believers. And if it is good as individuals to remind ourselves of our Ebenezers, it is even more important as leaders, in whatever capacity, to remind each other of God's goodness, his promises, and his faithfulness. The Apostle Paul, writing to Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 2, encourages him to entrust the things that he has heard Paul say to reliable people who will be qualified to teach others. And that way, we pass on what we have learned to the next generations. And as well as teaching, we can also remind ourselves of God's goodness and his help through our worship. Paul writes in his letter to both the Ephesians and the Colossians, encouraging them to let the word of Christ dwell in them through psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. So as well as being our act of worship to God in that moment, our hymns and songs can also be our reminders. And we know that, don't we? We all will have a favourite hymn or song or a phrase, and we will know why that particular verse or phrase means something to us. They help us to remember. And finally, we are commanded by Jesus himself to remind ourselves and each other of his death for us. And we will do that again this morning. The Lord's table is perhaps the greatest Ebenezer that we can raise. That God has dealt with our gravest need, overcome our biggest enemy, at a time when we were most helpless to do anything to save ourselves. Amen.